Most of us have experienced pain. We fear it and we try to avoid it. But do we know what it really is? There is the story of pain in all its forms, from everyday aches and pain, aches and chronic afflictions, to pure agony, covering everything from phantom aches to feeling other people's pain or having no sensation at all. Dr. Monty Lyman examines what it means, explains what it is to feel pain. The Painful Truth by Dr. Monty Lyman. Delighted to join me live on the line, hopefully without much pain. Monty himself. Shall I call you Dr. Monty? Shall I call you Monty? Shall I call you Dr. Lyman? What should we call you today?
Oh, Monty's absolutely fine, Giles. Thanks for having me on.
The pleasure is all mine. Yeah, pain, it's a subject we shy away from for very good reason. But in your book, you make the argument that we haven't really done that much research into the world of pain, if you'll pardon the pun, and we base our theories of pain on the discoveries of several 100 years ago.
Yes, that's it's really interesting. I mean, we all experience pain. We all know pain when we experience it. But actually, we don't know that much about it. Well, actually, there's been quite a lot of exciting recent research about pain and what it is. But actually, a lot of that hasn't filtered down to medical professionals, doctors, and people in general. And what this book was about really is changing our perceptions about pain. I think most of us, including doctors, assume that, quite understandably, that pain is always an accurate measure of injury in our tissues. Or actually, the sort of main message of my book is that pain is a protector. Pain is a protective mechanism. But also, I think chronic pain is the greatest disease we don't talk about. I mean, about a fifth to a third of Brits live with persistent chronic pain. Yet it was only classified as a disease in its own right in 2019. Medical students only study it for about 13 hours in their 6 years of medical school. And I think it's just time we started to talk about chronic pain.
Talking about chronic pain, and there are obviously different levels of pain, but that thing you said before about it's a warning sign if you have pain. I mean, sometimes you say, oh, if only I couldn't feel pain, and there are some very rare medical conditions where you can't feel pain, and that is really dangerous.
Precisely. I have interviewed a couple of people and written about individuals who have something called congenital insensitivity to pain, which is essentially because of a genetic mutation, you don't feel any pain at all, or you can't pick up the danger signals that say, if you cut your hand, you don't feel it. And most of these people don't live past their teens. If you think about it, it's, if you have appendicitis, if you break a leg, if you don't know that you've broken it, you're going to get a horrendous infection, or you're going to bleed out inside and not understand, and you won't know that you're in danger. So pain is a protector. One of the most interesting people I interviewed was a woman called Jo, who's from Inverness, and she's in her 70s, but she only discovered that she doesn't feel pain in her mid 60s. So she started walking with a bit of a limp, but didn't cause her any pain at all. She had an X-ray done at the hospital, and it showed really terrible osteoarthritis in her hip. It was bone on bone, but she didn't feel any pain. And then the doctor had a look at her hands and saw that her sort of thumbs and her fingers were sort of out of place. And they had took X-rays of her hands, and she had terrible arthritis in her hands, but she didn't feel any pain. But then the anaesthetist was really worried when she underwent surgery to fix this, called a trapeziectomy, which essentially involves moving bones around in your hand. It should be completely agonizing, but she didn't require any anesthetic. And essentially, the anaesthetist sent her down to London to have a genetic test. And she's actually the only person in the world to have a mutation. And usually in our body produces its own cannabinoids, essentially molecules that you can find in the cannabis plant. And this naturally dampens down pain. But we need to break it down because we need to feel pain. But in Jo's case, she lacked the molecule that breaks down this cannabis molecule in our blood. So essentially, she's constantly high. She has very high levels of cannabis in her cannabis sort of molecules in her blood. So it's very interesting seeing that actually the people who don't feel pain show us that pain is really important, but also could lead to future medical discoveries.
I was going to say, because that, I mean, that is the breakdown of the molecules that you said could lead to future painkillers. I mean, presumably the science of actually treating pain, has that advanced in, say, the past 100 stroke 50 years?
In some ways, yes. And I think we're quite good. Doctors are quite good at treating what's known as acute pain, so short-term pain. So if you break a bone or you have a cut or something like that, you burn yourself. There are lots of, say, painkillers that are very good at reducing pain. But what's really interesting is for chronic pain, so pain that goes on for longer than the time for the tissue to heal, so usually pain that persists over sort of 3-4 months, actually painkillers don't tend to work for that. And even sort of opioids, things like morphine and oxycodone, actually for most people, they don't work. And the new science is showing that actually there are the things that do work are not drug related. So actually, teaching people what pain is, that pain's a protector, not an accurate detector of injury, that you can hurt but not have harm, things like that, educational courses can help reduce pain. And things like encouraging people to move and various ways of reducing inflammation in the body via diet and things like that. But what I need to make clear is that even when pain persists, pain can essentially become written on the brain. The brain can learn pain. It becomes a disease in and of itself. It becomes neurological. But that doesn't mean it's sort of all in your head. It doesn't mean you can just think it away. But sort of, I think we're understanding that actually painkillers in most cases aren't very effective for long-term pain.
I mean,
there are other solutions.
That's been one of the say in the States, in the medical industry in the States, that's been one of the scandals, the opioid crisis, because because at the time the medical wisdom said, well, just take, in the 50s and 60s, just take a pill, take a couple of pills and take three and call me in the morning kind of approach to treating anything, really.
Oh, definitely. I think in the States it was particularly bad, and that was, partly the result of the lobbying from the big pharma companies. Completely true. And between 2015 and 2018, the USA experienced its first drop in life expectancy since the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, and that was because of the opioid crisis. Deaths because of opioids. I mean, it's probably changed because of COVID since then, but it's a considerable issue in the US, and it also is in Europe and in the UK. But the trouble is, doctors are beginning to understand that we should potentially start to reduce or not give out opioids for chronic pain so freely. But understandably, people in pain are saying, well, what else are you going to do? What other options do I have for my horrible real pain? And that's why I think we need to invest massively in persistent or chronic pain teams to come alongside people and to show them that there is another way to help live with their pain, reduce their pain, and potentially eliminate their pain that doesn't involve opioids.
I'm interested when you say that pain can be, can be rewired into our brains. So, I mean, that brings up, I mean, and I'm not suggesting, oh, it's all, get better. It's, you may have lost a leg, but it's all in your mind. But how do you, and without going down the holistic medicine sort of wormhole, if you like, because, a lot of people say, well, take cannabis oil and, your hair will grow back or whatever, and there are some things of that. But so how do we treat the whole then? Is it a case of you do prevention before? Are we looking at lifestyle? Have we in the past 50 years become so used to processed food, lack of exercise? I mean, we're all living longer, but then you have the whole quality of life as opposed to quantity of life debate. So how do we rewire our brains to act proactively against pains that can be brought on by our very lifestyle?
Justin, you've raised some very important points. And I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of our modern lifestyles are just a perfect cocktail for pain. In terms of actually constant chronic stress and essentially anything that increases the levels of threat to the brain increases pain. But anything that gives cues of safety reduces pain. But then also when you mentioned processed foods, I think there's a lot of evidence that a lot of us are living with chronic inflammation, low levels of inflammation in the body that also affect the brain and that can actually make it easier for short-term pain from an injury or something like that to actually become embedded in the brain even when the injury is healed. So generally the therapies that have been shown to work are things that make, I call it therapies that make the brain feel safe in its body. Things that give the brain cues that the body is safe. So the first one is understanding what pain is. And there are lots of really good resources out there, free resources. There's one called Flipping Pain, which is accessible online. And that's really, really, really useful. But also things like movement. Even if you are in pain, if you have someone who can help you slowly but surely begin to move again, you know, that's really helpful. And it gives the brain cues that the body is healing. You know, the risk of being sedentary is much higher than the risk of movement. And then there are also other things such as anything that reduces stress, but also anything that reduces social stress as well. I think that's the social element of pain is really important. Loneliness is a massive, is fuel for pain's fire. So finding ways of being able to socialize and engage in purposeful activity are actually things that make the brain feel safe. I mean, as a doctor and talking about this to other doctors, it can sound a bit light and a bit waffly, but actually it's as humans, this is the way in which we can essentially rewire our brains into feeling safe and reducing pain.
Going back to that point about, you know, social interaction, I mean, we are social animals. That, you know, we are, by our very nature, it's always been so. We have been through an interesting time, and I use that word advisedly, where a lot of people have been spending time on their own. Have you found that if you do spend time on your own, not of your own choosing, perhaps, you know, because of socialization, because of lockdown, because of whatever else, it has an effect on your immune system, so therefore you are run down, so therefore you are more susceptible to any infections or any viruses that are going, and I'm not, you know, masks notwithstanding, and B, you will feel more pain if you are on your own, strange though it may seem, and sort of a bit woolly perhaps.
Definitely, I completely agree. I pick up on that last point. There have been a lot of studies that have shown in experimental conditions, if you are socially rejected, say for example there's one where you're playing a ball game online, and where they were studying people's brains, when you experience social isolation or social rejection, the same areas that are activated when you're experiencing physical pain light up. So the brain sees that as pain. That's probably because actually, if we're outside of our group, if we're on our own, the brain sees that as a threat to our survival. So it's more likely to create pain. So the very act of being on your own increases the likelihood of you experiencing pain. And there have been lots of studies that show that things like team sports, pain choirs, singing groups with groups of people, and knitting groups and things like that. Knitting's an amazing, has a lot of evidence actually, and group knitting in terms of reducing chronic pain. So anything that increases socialization reduces persistent pain. But I also agree with you on the element of, if our being isolated can affect our immune system in lots of different ways. If we're not exposing ourselves to the outdoors, if we're not moving, and eating habits have changed a little bit as well, and if we're not doing any of those things, then that is also fuel for pain's fire. So I think actually the COVID-19 pandemic has been very bad for persistent pain, and also I think there's also interesting evidence about long COVID, people who've had COVID, and whether that inflammation, that long-term inflammation that some people have after COVID, could make it easier for pain to become embedded on the brain. But that's something that's in its infancy in terms of research.
Yeah, the long-term effects on that one. My cousin is currently suffering from long-term COVID, and she used to run marathons, and now she can't do more than 5Ks. She's written about it. She's the features editor on the Metro, and she's written about the effects on that and how it's blindsided her. We talked about looking at, at social isolation, etc., and rewiring the brain. What about placebos? Because if you suggest to somebody that this is something that will make you feel better, do our brains therefore pick up on that and go, okay, well, the doctor's told me this. It looks good. So therefore, you can negate pain by a healthy placebo, shall we say?
That's a really, really interesting topic. And I think, and you touched on something, very perceptibly there in terms of, you know, I don't think it should be called the placebo effect. I think it should be called the expectation effect. So it's not the sugar pill that you're given that works. It's the cues that you're going to get better by taking this pill. It's the brain thinking that it's going to be made safe. And it's really interesting. There are lots of really interesting studies that show actually there's the placebo effect. There's also the nocebo effect. So if you believe that something's not going to work or going to make you worse, that will worsen pain. So if you believe that if a doctor doesn't really explain something well to you, or you see a scan and it says, oh, you've got a bit of a disc bulge, which actually in most cases doesn't means nothing. But if you see that scan and oh, it's a disc bulge, or my spine must be crumbling, and the doctor doesn't explain it to you very well, and you think you're more damaged than you actually are, then that can worsen pain a lot. And so I think the placebo effect is a huge, it's all about confidence between the caregiver, the doctor, and the patient. And it's all about the relationship and the context in which treatments are given. So, for example, I think it's so important that people can see their doctors face to face if they want to. I think GP consultations should go on for longer. I mean, that's a whole can of worms in terms of policy and things like that. But it's the accurate act of interaction with someone else and being believed and having things explained to you is medicine in and of itself, and increases the effect of whatever pill or treatment you're given. So there are lots of treatments, so massage and acupuncture and things like that, which can work for a lot of people. And it seems that the vast majority of the effect of that, and in some of these cases, all of the effect, is due to a powerful placebo effect.
That's an interesting, that's a really interesting one, because, I mean, I like it, because you're basically saying that the very act of face-to-face communication with somebody, not on a screen, not on an email, not via a helpline or whatever line, but that actual face-to-face consultation is actually part of a medicinal process, of a healing process, more than just going to, going online and ordering ordering whatever medication you should need.
Completely agree. Oh, we're made for connection, and that's what the placebo research in the last sort of 10, 15 years is revealing. It's really interesting.
Just going on, just a quick point here. I mean, you know, that's, and it's very American. It's very Oprah Winfrey. But you know, I feel your pain. You know, it's social media are feeling your pain, you know, feeling sense. Can you actually feel somebody's pain? Is pain contagious? And I don't mean the guy next to you, you know, bangs his elbow, and you go, oh my goodness. But is there evidence to support that you can actually feel somebody's pain?
Yeah, completely. That's absolutely fascinating. I've interviewed an American neurologist called Joel Salinas, and he has something called mirror touch synesthesia. So whenever he sees someone essentially being touched on their face. So I did a Zoom interview with him, and I sort of stroked one side of my face, and he was in Boston, and he could feel it on his face.
Good grief.
Or at least, and I mean, that is slightly extreme. And yeah. I asked, you know, why did he become a doctor? And he said, well, yeah, it's good. I didn't become a trauma surgeon, because he said when he was a medical student, seeing people having a cardiac arrest and undergoing CPR, he could feel his chest being crushed and feel the breath going out of his mouth. I mean, that is very extreme. But all of us are mirrors to some extent. If you if you go on YouTube or something like that, and you look at reaction videos where you see people's faces and reactions to funny or shocking videos, if you look at ones where they look at people experiencing pain, you can see them reacting as though they're in pain as well. And all the evidence shows that if you see someone in pain, the areas of your brain that light up when, or that are activated when you're in pain, light up as well. Now, why is that the case? Pain is a teacher and a doctor. It tells you that, you know, don't touch that thing that burnt you, or don't go near that, you know, saber-toothed tiger that bit you. But actually, so that's important in one respect. But if you can see someone else experiencing pain, if you can feel that pain that they're experiencing, that will teach you not to go near that animal or that substance or whatever. So it's not just knowing that they're in pain; it's actually catching their pain a bit and feeling it. And there are things in the brain called a mirror system in the brain, which so we, in a sense, we do catch pain from other people.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Are there any sort of easy, quick fixes you can do to avoid pain or lessen pain? Is it like you said, diet, exercise? We're always told these, but the reason we're always being told these is presumably because they're effective.
That's true, and often lifestyle changes are can seem a bit dull and can seem a bit basic, and they do work, but often they require a lot of effort, not just from the person in pain, but from the people around them to support them. And that's why I think that pain should drive us to love, in terms of if we know someone who is living with persistent pain, you know, we have the responsibility to help them on their journey. But quick fixes, no, but I think the key to living with, reducing, and even eliminating a long-term pain is truly understanding what it is, beginning to change your perspective. And there are different educational courses that are free, that are interesting, fun, and accessible. And that's just a good place to start.
The book is called The Painful Truth. It's by Monty Lyman. It's out now, or tomorrow, on Penguin Random House. If people want to find out more information about you or about the book, is there social media, is the website? Where can they find you?
Oh, yes. So I think I'm the only Monty Lyman in the world. So if you look at Twitter, Instagram, and yeah, I've got a website, Monty Lyman.
The book is called The Painful Truth. One final question, Dr. Lyman. Why is it then, of all the pains, that the two greatest ones are the stray Lego piece, and when you get your little toe on that corner of the kit of the coffee table, why are those the most painful pains known to man?
Oh, I completely agree with you, and I think that is a medical mystery, and I think that's where the next future direction of research should go in.
We look forward to that one then, but this is a fabulous book. The book is called The Painful Truth. It's by Dr. Monty Lyman. And Monty, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Charles.